We continue in chapter 3, Self-Surrender in Works, the Way of the Gita. We'll have to spend some time this evening discussing aspects of the Sankhya system as we go through, so bear with me. I'm not deliberately trying to interrupt the flow of Sri Aurobindo's language, but we can't presume that everybody that's with us in person or in Zoom has had the chance to study to great depth the Sankhya philosophy, so we'll go a little gradually through it. A distinction has to be firmly seized in our consciousness. The capital distinction between mechanical nature and the free lord of nature, between the Ishvara, or single luminous divine will, and the many executive modes and forces of the universe. Remember, Sri Aurobindo's chapter is about the approach to works in the Gita, based on germinal insights from the Gita. But the Sankhya philosophy that the Gita knows is much earlier than what later was formulated in the Sankhya Karikas and attributed to, of course, Kapila. Kapila is a great sage whose deep insight lies at the basis of many schools that lead to spiritual liberation. Kapila saw that when you seat yourself deeply within your own consciousness, that you become free from your own thoughts, from your own feelings, from your own sensations, in addition to being free from the world around and the world at large. His insight was so sharp and deep that you'd see that all that we call ourselves ordinarily, that all that we call ourselves ordinarily is but the structuring of nature. There is no aspect of our experience of the world that does not deliver to us information about nature. But none of that is information about the deeper person, the nature of who watches all of this. Kapila's great victory was that he could house himself in that essential awareness and see everything else as external to his own being. And there are myths surrounding him that when certain kshatriyas approach him as he is deep in the cave of being, he incinerates them with a mere glance from his vision. Later we'll see that Shiva has that capacity to destroy from his seat of austerity anything that would interrupt or disturb his tapasya. So Kapila is imaged as doing this, but it is a metaphor. Kapila so deep in his consciousness, could hold off, could rebuke any attempt to dislodge him from that concentration. So perfect was his awareness in that. And so that becomes this insight between the person inside, whom we can call Purusha, and that outside, which is nature, which is Prakriti. And the words themselves have meaning. Purusha literally means he, referring to the masculine person. But what it isn't a preference in terms of gender, except that the culture is built like that. What it conveys is that the Purusha is actually sovereign. As long as we accept what nature brings to us, unwittingly receiving it, not weighing it, not assessing, not going back to the roots of things, then we are its toy, its master of us. But the Purusha has an innate sovereignty that if it wishes to extend it, it can become victorious. So the Purusha is also seen as the witness, the Sakshi, who simply sees, but also can be Anumanta, who can possess a will that is placed upon nature and insists that nature do what the Purusha demands. So the old idea is not that Purusha and Prakriti are absolutely distinct, but there is a deep connection in a single reality that permits that interface to be productive. Already there is a presumed interface, no, because it is only by the Purusha's gaze that Prakriti feels impelled to move, to dance. Prakriti means that which brings forth in terms of work. It produces. It's a stage production to please, to bring enjoyment to that which would watch. It's the bifurcation of a single being into a static and witnessing poise and a dynamic executive poise. Still one being. So this is what Sri Aurobindo begins with. The later development of the Sankhya philosophy, of course, will bring in the nature of what constructs the action of Prakriti, which would be the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is the principle of equilibrium and light, and rajas is the principle of energy and restless movement, and tamas is the principle of inertia, of stability. Other insights unroll from that, but the way that the philosophy of Sankhya articulates it is that when Purusha sees Prakriti, Prakriti springs into action. As long as Purusha's gaze goes inside and does not witness Prakriti, there is no dance of nature, there is no creation. But when Purusha regards Prakriti, that very act of regarding releases from Mula Prakriti these three gunas into activity. So there is like a root nature which is stable, unmoving. You can imagine the expansion of the cosmos, the retraction of the cosmos back into stability. Another expansion, this all regarding whether the eye is open and looking or whether the eye is closed and intent within. When the eye is open and sees nature, then there is this action. The gunas begin. They begin their interplay. And all things are composite of all three gunas. There is no pure experience of gunas. You can't experience only sattva, only rajas, only tamas. There can be a predominance in the adjectives then, based. And the adjectives then become sattvika. Sattvic would mean that predominantly the principle of light and equilibrium is at work, arranging, composing, harmonizing the scene. When things become rajasic, then there's restless energy, things become feverish, we lose clarity, but we gain in passion. And when we become tamasic, we are rooted in inertia, we have little awareness and little energy. But all three gunas, all three elements, will be in each moment, in each object. There is nothing that does not contain all three, according to the cosmology of the Sankhya system. So maybe we've said enough about that. That's as the whole system goes. Remember, though, that the Sankhya of the Gita is not the same as the later Sankhya philosophy, which becomes part and parcel of a whole worldview combined with the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Sankhya and Yoga go together in the later development of Indian philosophy. So that is not the same thing as what we see in the Gita. We have a kind of, it's a developed Sankhya worldview. It's far more developed than what we would have got from Kapila, whose leading insights formed it all, but he's thousands of years earlier than what we see in the Gita. The Gita, again, probably 4th century BCE, into the 2nd century CE, so 600 years later or so, is when we get Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And thousands of years farther back is where Kapila lives, in the age of the Vedas. So, onward. Let's read that first sentence again. A distinction has to be firmly seized in our consciousness. The capital distinction between mechanical nature, prakriti, and the free lord of nature, between the Ishvara, or single luminous divine will, and the many executive modes and forces of the universe. Ishvara is not identical with Purusha. Let's not confuse these categories. In the later Sankhya field, there is an Ishvara, but that's a third category of being. Primarily, our experience would be to find the Purusha, regard everything else out here that we experience as prakriti. Purusha would be essential awareness. When we're conscious of an object, conscious of a feeling or an emotion, that is the play of prakriti, not consciousness itself. Consciousness itself is abstract from all of this play. And here, too, there's the suggestion coming up that we'll make plain that Ishvara, or Lord, in the Gita's system, surveys all of nature, the supreme nature above, para prakriti, and the nature that we experience here in the triple play of the gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are an extension into prakriti of what is ultimately and originally a higher nature. And Ishvara is lord of that higher nature, but by implication is master too of all things moving in the universe. So, he continues, nature, not as she is in her divine truth, the conscious power of the eternal. But as she appears to us in the ignorance, is executive force, mechanical in her steps, not consciously intelligent to our experience of her, although all her works are instinct with an absolute intelligence. So in other words, the consciousness of the Lord through his higher nature, through Paraprakriti, is immanent even in the world of phenomena that we experience. If she is the conscious power of the eternal, then she would be Chit Shakti of Sat. She would be that Paraprakriti. Sri Aurobindo, as you know, often phrases into English things which have Sanskrit equivalents. And often you remember from our study of the Life Divine, he refers back to that seminal idea that comes in theistic Vedanta rather late, that this is all the play of Sat Chit Ananda. Existence, consciousness, delight. Not in herself, Master. She is full of a self-aware power, which has an infinite mastery. And because of this power driving her, she rules all and exactly fulfills the work intended in her by the Ishwara. There's a footnote. This power is the conscious divine Shakti of the Ishwara, the transcendent and universal Mother. Transcendent, there, para. Universal, Prakriti itself. So she is coextensive. She is transcendent. Two, she creates a perfect universe above, because para prakriti means that there is already a constellation of self-aware beings in a multitude above. Remember, the Gita speaks about the jiva bhuti that come out from her. And then she is this world as well, Prakriti as we experience it in a divided way. Not enjoying, but enjoyed. She bears in herself the burden of all enjoyments. Nature as Prakriti is an inertly active force, for she works out a movement imposed upon her, but within her is one that knows. Some entity sits there that is aware of all her motion and process. So this is different from the Sankhya system, right? Because this is not a single purusha, say an individual soul, observing nature and claiming freedom from it. This is a oneness which is transcendent, universal, sitting within all, silently, quietly guiding things forward to a predestined goal, towards a self-chosen culmination that this one wishes to happen. Prakriti works, containing the knowledge, the mastery, the delight of the Purusha, the being associated with her or seated within her, but she can participate in them only by subjection and reflection of that which fills her. So this is nature as it operates in the regular universe, our universe of experience, the field of the ignorance. This is not Paraprakriti, this is regular Prakriti. But look who's active here. Knowledge, mastery, and delight. Knowledge of the real being, that's Sat. Mastery, that's Chit Shakti, dancing. Delight, Ananda. So again, Sat Chit Ananda. Purusha knows and is still and inactive. He contains the action of Prakriti within his consciousness and knowledge and enjoys it. He gives the sanction to Prakriti's works, and she works out what is sanctioned by him for his pleasure. Purusha himself does not execute. He maintains Prakriti in her action and allows her to express in energy and process and formed result what he perceives in his knowledge. This is the distinction made by the Sankhyas. And although it is not all the true truth, not in any way the highest truth either of Purusha or of Prakriti, still it is a valid and indispensable practical knowledge in the lower hemisphere of existence. The Sankhya is plural. Sankhya means enumeration, so these are ways of enumerating, counting the principles of existence. So we have Purusha, so we have Prakriti, we have an Ishvara above, perhaps. And then we have all the categories of being, and we count all of those too. We have the measuring, the insightful, intelligent will, the buddhi. We have the manas, the mind, which gathers all the data from the senses, both subtle and gross. And we have the objects, both subtle and gross. And all of that together forms the field of nature, which Purusha simply watches. He says here, it's a valid and indispensable practical knowledge. You'll find in his letters on yoga also that he frequently encourages a seeker to first get stabilized in the separation of your own deeper being from the externalities of nature, and in that you'll find peace and illumination and no longer be subject to the chain of nature. It can't tell you what to do anymore when you know what you really are. Otherwise, you're still rather chained to your received nature from environment, from custom, from your own genetic predispositions. Whatever went into the construct of your nature becomes you until you do something about it. And the thing that you do about it is have an insight into your soul, into the Purusha. That gives you the first freedom. Even if that's not the highest answer about how do we wind up with two principles opposing each other, where does unity come from? What's the secret of oneness? Well, Sankhya is not going to answer that question, but it will give you that first liberation. It's important. The individual soul, or the conscious being in a form, may identify itself with this experiencing Purusha or with this active Prakriti. You can be this, you can be that. If it identifies itself with Prakriti, it is not master, enjoyer, and knower, but reflects the modes and workings of Prakriti. It enters by its identification into that subjection and mechanical working which is characteristic of her. And even by an entire immersion in Prakriti, this soul becomes inconscient or subconscient, asleep in her forms as in the earth and the metal, or almost asleep as in plant life. There, in that inconscience, it is subject to the domination of tamas, the principle, the power, the qualitative mode of obscurity and inertia. Sattva and rajas are there, but they are concealed in the thick coating of tamas. Emerging into its own proper nature of consciousness, but not yet truly conscious, because there is still too great a domination of tamas in the nature, the embodied being becomes more and more subject to rajas, the principle, the power, the qualitative mode of action and passion impelled by desire and instinct. There is then formed and developed the animal nature, narrow in consciousness, rudimentary in intelligence, rajaso-tamasic in vital habit and impulse. emerging yet farther from the great inconscience towards a spiritual status, the embodied being liberates sattva, the mode of light, and acquires a relative freedom and mastery and knowledge, and with it, a qualified and conditioned sense of inner satisfaction and happiness. Man, the mental being in a physical body, should be, but is not, except in a few, among this multitude of ensouled bodies of this nature. So you can see he's traced the development of humankind out of tamas into rajas and now into mentality, but culminates by saying that humanity is not fully mentalized and certainly not sattvika. Ordinarily, he has too much in him of the obscure earth inertia and a troubled, ignorant animal life force to be a soul of light and bliss, or even a mind of harmonious will and knowledge. There is here in man an incomplete and still hampered and baffled ascension towards the true character of the Purusha, free, master, knower, and enjoyer. For these are, in human and earthly experience, relative modes, none giving its single and absolute fruit. All are intermixed with each other, and there is not the pure action of any one of them anywhere. It is their confused and inconstant interaction that determines the experiences of the egoistic human consciousness swinging in nature's uncertain balance. The sign of the immersion of the embodied soul in Prakriti is the limitation of consciousness to the ego. So whenever we're restricted in our awareness to simply being, it's all about me, we can know that we're fully identified with Prakriti. No longer are we sovereign of our nature. No longer are we Purusha. The vivid stamp of this limited consciousness can be seen in a constant inequality of the mind and heart, and a confused conflict and disharmony in their varied reactions to the touches of experience. The human reactions sway perpetually between the dualities created by the soul's subjection to nature, and by its often intense but narrow struggle for mastery and enjoyment, a struggle for the most part ineffective. The soul circles in an unending round of nature's alluring and distressing opposites, success and failure, good fortune and ill fortune, good and evil, sin and virtue, joy and grief, pain and pleasure. It is only when awaking from its immersion in Prakriti, it perceives its oneness with the One, and its oneness with all existences, that it can become free from these things and found its right relation to this executive world nature. Then it becomes indifferent to her inferior modes, equal-minded to her dualities, capable of mastery and freedom. It is seated above her as the high-throned knower and witness, filled with the calm, intense, unalloyed delight of his own eternal existence. Udasinata, seated above, equal-minded, having that equality, samatha, perceiving that oneness with all existences, as in the Gita, in the last chapter, the 20th verse, 1820. The embodied spirit continues to express its powers in action, but it is no longer involved in ignorance, no longer bound by its works. Its actions have no longer a consequence within it, but only a consequence outside in Prakriti. You see what this means? Having discovered the soul and begun to act from the soul, the actions generated in nature have no karmic value for the soul. It is free action because you don't need to learn a lesson from it anymore. That energy just stays in circulation within nature. It is not posited towards you. If you're free, and if you have given up that action, which the Gita in its second chapter adjures all to do, you have a right to the action, no right to the fruit. So that's the first thing. You do the work, you give it, your ego becomes less and less. Eventually, the divine will works through you. There is no ego of moment, and the soul in you emerges and lives in oneness with that will as it conducts its work in the world. Then you are a co-agent, a collaborator with the divine will, and what work is done goes to that who does the work really. There is no fictional ego trying to claim it or needing to claim it to advance on the scale of evolution, to come to self-awareness, you see. No longer bound by its works, its actions have no longer a consequence within it, but only a consequence outside in Prakriti. The whole movement of nature becomes to its experience a rising and falling of waves on the surface that make no difference to its own unfathomable peace, its wide delight, its vast universal equality, or its boundless God existence. And we have here a footnote. It is not indispensable for the Karma Yoga to accept implicitly all the philosophy of the Gita. We may regard it, if we like, as a statement of psychological experience useful as a practical basis for the yoga. Here, it is perfectly valid and in entire consonance with a high and wide experience. For this reason, I have thought it well to state it here as far as possible in the language of modern thought, omitting all that belongs to metaphysics rather than to psychology. So in other words, he's trying to get to the core of what this means to us as conscious beings as we can develop and not deal with the philosophy of it, with the mechanistic aspects of the system of the Sankhya. That's not his business. I think we have time for a bit more. These are the conditions of our effort, and they point to an ideal which can be expressed in these or in equivalent formulae. To live in God and not in the ego. To move, vastly founded, not in the little egoistic consciousness, but in the consciousness of the all-soul and the transcendent. Now, this is redolent of the phrasing in the Isha Upanishad. Its first verse speaks like this. To be perfectly equal in all happenings and to all beings, and to see and feel them as one with oneself and one with the divine, to feel all in oneself and all in God, to feel God in all, oneself in all. This is that equality, that samatha, this is that experience of the one, eka, that the Gita speaks of, but also the Isha Upanishad, again, older than the Gita. And it's sixth verse, also 7 and 8, and goes on into 9. To act in God and not in the ego. And here, first, not to choose action by reference to personal needs and standards, but in obedience to the dictates of the living highest truth above us. So this requires us to step beyond simply being egoless and living in the universal divine will, to feeling ourselves one with all, with the one who inhabits all, but by raising our consciousness into oneness with this living highest truth. That means getting to the transcendent. In other words, he's inviting us to the supramental. Next, as soon as we are sufficiently founded in the spiritual consciousness, not to act any longer by our separate will or movement, but more and more to allow action to happen and develop under the impulsion and guidance of a divine will that surpasses us. So again, this is that supramental, but also that Purushottama of the Gita. Sri Aurobindo doesn't call our attention to the use of the term vijnana in the Gita, although it occurs there. But that reality is the key to understanding the nature of spirit and the nature of nature. Without that highest poise attained, one can't synthesize, one can't harmonize all the ends of being. And that secretly indwells and guides all. Remember, we've called attention to that last chapter of the Gita too, where he says, where Krishna says, I am as if mounted, I am in the core of your being, turning all creatures as if mounted upon a machine. That's the guidance of the divine will in each thing. And last, the supreme result, to be exalted into an identity in knowledge, force, consciousness, act, joy of existence with the divine Shakti. So again, exalted into this, and where does this occur? But in Satchit Ananda. What experiences that? That being above. What expresses that? That being above. So again, Sri Aurobindo, without using that language, is calling us to evolve to a realm of awareness and power and enjoyment, which is beyond this triple world of ignorance. He's calling us out of the realm of sattva, rajas, and tamas. We can perfect sattva, rajas, and tamas if we get that. To feel a dynamic movement, not dominated by mortal desire and vital instinct and impulse and elusive mental free will, but luminously conceived and evolved in an immortal self-delight and an infinite self-knowledge. For this is the action that comes by a conscious subjection and merging of the natural man into the divine self and eternal spirit. It is the spirit that forever transcends and guides this world nature. To be exalted into an identity and knowledge force, etc. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 65. there are lots of places in the Gita where oneness is spoken of, which is key to this whole chapter, isn't it? Including the 9th chapter, 15th verse, by the oneness. So I think we'll pause there and we'll finish the chapter next time when we meet. Another passage about oneness from Savitri. This is book two, the book of the traveler of the worlds. This is the beginning of this canto, Canto 1, The World Stare. Alone he moved, watched by the infinity around him and the unknowable above. All could be seen that shuns the mortal eye. All could be known the mind has never grasped. All could be done, no mortal will can dare. A limitless movement filled a limitless peace. In a profound existence beyond Earth's parent or kin to our ideas and dreams, where space is a vast experiment of the soul, in an immaterial substance linked to ours, in a deep oneness of all things that are, the universe of the unknown arose. A self-creation without end or pause revealed the grandeurs of the infinite. It flung into the hazards of its play a million moods, a myriad energies, the world shapes that are fancies of its truth, and the formulas of the freedom of its force. It poured into the ever-stable's flux a Bacchic rapture and revel of ideas, a passion and motion of everlastingness. There rose unborn into the unchanging surge thoughts that abide in their deathless consequence, words that immortal last, though fallen mute, acts that brought out from silence its dumb sense, lines that convey the inexpressible. The eternal's stillness saw in unmoved joy his universal power at work display in plots of pain and dramas of delight, the wonder and beauty of her will to be. All, even pain, was the soul's pleasure here. Here all experience was a single plan, the thousandfold expression of the One. All came at once into his single view. Nothing escaped his vast intuitive sight. Nothing drew near he could not feel as kin. He was one spirit with that immensity, images in a supernal consciousness, embodying the unborn who never dies, the structured visions of the cosmic self, alive with the touch of being's eternity, looked at him like form-bound spiritual thoughts, figuring the movements of the ineffable. Aspects of being donned world outline, forms that open moving doors on things divine became familiar to his hourly sight. The symbols of the spirit's reality, the living bodies of the bodiless, grew near to him, his daily associates. The exhaustless seeings of the unsleeping mind, letterings of its contact with the invisible, surrounded him with countless pointing signs. The voices of a thousand realms of life missioned to him her mighty messages. The heaven hints that invade our earthly lives, the dire imaginations dreamed by hell, which if enacted and experienced here, our dulled capacity soon would cease to feel, or our mortal frailty could not long endure, were set in their sublime proportions there. There, lived out in their self-born atmosphere, they resumed their topless pitch and native power, their fortifying stress upon the soul, bit deep into the ground of consciousness, the passion and purity of their extremes, the absoluteness of their single cry, and the sovereign sweetness or violent poetry of their beautiful or terrible delight. All thought can know, or widest sight perceive, and all that thought and sight can never know, all things occult and rare, remote and strange, were near to heart's contact, felt by spirit sense. Asking for entry at his nature's gates, they crowded the widened spaces of his mind, his self-discoveries flaming witnesses, offering their marvel and their multitude. Namaste, Jai Ma.